It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrat.
And I'm Veronica Wicker. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on the eve of the big deer hunting season, our guest says Wisconsin could learn lessons from other states when it comes to managing chronic wasting disease.
First, a bill that would expand background checks on Iraqi and Syrian refugees hoping to enter the United States is moving quickly through the U.S. Congress. The American Security Against Foreign Enemies, or SAFE, Act was introduced on Tuesday. It was voted on by the House of Representatives yesterday.
The bill passed by a substantial margin with almost all Republicans and 47 Democrats voting in favor. The president had said he would veto the bill if it also passes the Senate.
One Democrat who voted in favor of the SAFE Act is Ron Kind. He represents Wisconsin's 3rd Congressional District in western Wisconsin, and he joins us now. Representative Kind, thanks for being with us today.
My pleasure.
Under the current system, before this new legislation, what kind of vetting process do people seeking refugee status in the U.S. go through?
Well, it's very long and it's very tedious. It's about 18 to 24 months of background checks, of searches and vetting. And so it's not easy, you know, for you to be a political refugee and gain entrance here in the United States. And I don't think people realize just the difficulty it is for refugees to come here.
And as I understand it, in a recent CNN article, they said that 18, 24 months could actually go a little longer from a place like Syria, given that there's even more security concerns there.
Well, there is, and also a lack of information. A lot of the people fleeing Syria right now from the violence and terrorism, there's not a lot of good documentation in order to do background checks and that. So that tends to slow things down. But it's quite frankly, one of the questions I asked of the administration this week with the numerous classified briefings we had is, why is it taking so long from 18 to 24 months in order to properly screen and do background checks on these families who are looking for a safe haven and escaping the type of violence and terrorism in their lives. And they just said that a lot of times it's because of the lack of documentation and information that things slow down.
Well, you voted in favor of this American Security Against Foreign Enemies Act. I'll ask you about the details of that in a bit. But given what you just said, the slow, lengthy, difficult process seems like one of the worst ways to try to infiltrate the United States. Why did you see the need for more layers on top of that?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. First of all, the message it sends to ISIS, and it's this. Don't even think about it. Don't even try to infiltrate these Syrian families who are trying to escape your violence, your terrorism, and find a safe haven for their children, because it's not going to work, and we're going to catch you. But secondly, people really do need to take a quick look at the bill. It's very short. It's about one page. And all it's asking the administration to do is this. It requires the federal intelligence and security and law enforcement agencies to get on the same page, to talk to each other and exchange information as they're going through these background checks so that we're certain that the people that we're bringing into this country do not pose a security threat to our nation. And quite frankly, it was those type of gaps that existed that led to 9/11 and the attacks upon us back then. It was these agencies operating in their own silos and not exchanging information, in essence, not playing nice with one another, that led to a lot of intelligence gaps. And so this legislation, I think, wants to ensure that that doesn't happen again, that we're deploying our resources and getting the information that we need to properly screen these families so we can bring them in to the United States for resettlement purposes.
Well, that's broadly stated, having those agencies talk to each other. On a practical level, what would this act require them to do?
Well, it requires that. The language itself is requires the FBI, the National Security Agency, and also the intel agencies to talk to each other and exchange information when it comes to the screening and the background checks of these Syrian refugees. And again, based on my conversations I had with the administration, they say that they're doing a lot of that already. They feel very confident with the screening and the background check system that they do have in place. And if that's the case, then they ought to view this legislation as pretty benign. Because if we're merely asking them to do what they're doing today, then it's not a very high hurdle for them to reach.
Is there a risk that the refugee process would have to stop altogether, assuming this passes while these new procedures are put into place?
I don't think so. Listen, 3/4 of the Syrian refugees who we are looking at right now are women with young children. And if the administration can't certify that these women with their young children come to the United States does not pose a security threat to us, then we are in trouble. And we've got some big concerns that need to be addressed. So I don't think this is going to slow the process down, or quite frankly, I wouldn't have supported the legislation. And the administration ought not be concerned about putting that stamp of approval on these Syrian refugees coming to our country. I don't think this legislation addresses some of the gaps that exist, all the gaps that exist. Quite frankly, I think the visa waiver issue with European citizens need to be looked at, because, let's face it, the terrorists that did attack Paris this past week were French and Belgium citizens. And yet now they can come to the United States for 90 days visa-free, and that's a concern that I have. And there are other aspects, too, of our counterterrorism and our intelligence gathering system that I think needs to be addressed. So this legislation, I thought, was relatively benign, but it's not the panacea. It's not the answer to closing the gaps in order to make us more secure, ultimately.
Talking to Representative Ron Kind from Wisconsin, looking at new legislation on Syrian refugees and the process involved in bringing them into this country. There has been talk in Congress from some Republicans in the House saying this doesn't go far enough. They're calling for a block on funding for Syrian refugee resettlement and the government funding bill due next month. Would you support that? Would you cross parties and vote with Republicans on that?
Where I give Speaker Ryan, you know, Paul Ryan, the new speaker now from Wisconsin, credit, because he did reach out to people like me this past week to talk to us about this legislation to make sure that he's not going over the cliff. And I think perhaps equally important is what this bill does not do. This bill does not shut down the Syrian refugee program. It does not defund it. It also does not apply a religious test for the first time in our nation's history. And Paul was up against some pressure within his own party to do exactly that. And to his credit, he didn't go down that dark road of religious tests and that. And it's another reason, quite frankly, I supported the legislation, because I'm so tired of the polarization, the hyperpartisan, and why every issue that comes up has to be knee-jerked opposed by the other side. And I refuse to play that political game when it comes to the national security of our nation. And Paul reached out, and he wanted to produce a bill that wasn't as controversial as some members of his party wanted to make it, and this is what we ended up with. I thought a fairly balanced approach of enhancing the background checks of Syrian refugees so that we can be certain that who we do bring into this country are safe and they don't pose a risk to anyone else.
There's been talk about what American actions look like as we respond to those attacks in Paris. Will this look to people, maybe in the Muslim world, this safe legislation, as a small but significant step towards slowing the flow, slowing American efforts to help Syrian refugees, maybe propaganda value for a group like ISIS?
Well, I think it all depends on how the media portrays it. Again, I just harken back to encouraging people to read the one-page bill, which is what it is. And because there's a lot of misinformation, there's a lot of mischaracterization about what this bill does or doesn't do. And quite frankly, at this moment of fear and high anxiety, you know, I've been taking a lot of phone calls over the last week, too, in light of the Paris attacks. Many of the people calling in are wondering if we're doing everything possible to ensure the safety and the security of our nation. And other people calling in are concerned that we may overreact and overreach and not reflect the type of values and principles that is true to our nation. And again, I was very sensitive to the equal concerns when addressing this legislation, trying to strike that right balance, and merely asking our intel and security agencies to work together when we're doing these screening checks and then verify that they're confident that who we're bringing in are safe. That is not an unreasonable request from my point of view. But a lot's going to depend on how this gets framed and how it is perceived. You're right.
Looking ahead, as we wrap up, some of your Democratic colleagues in the Senate say they will try to block this legislation. The White House saying, send it to us, we'll veto it. What would you say to your Democratic colleagues in the Senate and the White House?
Well, I'd say look at the legislation first. I think many of them probably haven't read the bill, and they're just going off from media reports or what they're hearing from their own circles and that. But again, you know, if you go back and start learning the lessons of history, especially the attacks on 9/11, the 9/11 Commission report was very clear that one of the failings that we had as a nation was the inability of our agencies or their unwillingness to work together, to share information, to communicate. They were operating in silos. And of course, it's the chief concern that we're trying to address in this refugee bill right now. So I don't think it's unreasonable or a heavy lift for our agencies to play nice and to share information. I mean, Washington is a place where information is knowledge, and therefore sharing it is giving up a little bit of that power in D.C. We can't afford that when it comes to our security interests and making sure that we're doing everything we can to prevent terrorist attacks both here and abroad.
Representative Kind, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Ron Kind, Democratic representative in Congress from Western Wisconsin. He was discussing his vote in favor of the American Security Against Foreign Enemies Act, which would increase the screening of Iraqis and Syrians seeking refugee status in the United States.
This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret.
With the gun deer season set to start tomorrow, we're looking at where Wisconsin is when it comes to chronic wasting disease. It's been well over a decade since chronic wasting disease was first discovered in the state. Today, it's spread to 38 of Wisconsin's 72 counties.
After years of pursuing a more aggressive approach that included sharpshooters and a lengthened gun deer season, the state is now scaling back its efforts for a more light-handed approach to CWD management. Our next guest compares Michigan's more aggressive approach to the disease with Wisconsin's, says the spread of the disease in our state could have bigger consequences than we realize.
Paul Smith wrote about that issue recently. He's the outdoor editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Paul, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Veronica. Good afternoon.
Well, what was the state's first approach when it came to managing chronic wasting disease?
When the disease was discovered in South Central Wisconsin in 2002, Wisconsin officials took a very aggressive stance toward managing the disease. The expressed goal at the time was eradication. And they knew at that time that was a very lofty goal. In fact, once this disease gets established, there has been no case where if it's in a large enough area that it's actually been eradicated. So it's a very difficult disease to handle. However, they go at it very aggressively, and after using these measures such as sharpshooting and lengthened seasons, they started getting some pushback from landowners and some members of the hunting community, and started to back off on those efforts after several years. And additional testing also showed that the disease was more widespread than at first hoped. So where we find ourselves now after 13 years is the department no longer tries to control the disease, but merely conducts spotty surveillance around the state.
Right, and you write that in 2012, the Deer Trustees Report advised a more passive approach to chronic wasting disease management. Why did they make that recommendation at that time?
Yeah, that was in response to concerns from some landowners and some hunters and others, say wildlife watchers. The deer resource does have value, you know, to many people in our state, and there was a enough pushback from folks who didn't want, for instance, sharpshooting occurring on their property or near their properties, and the Deer Trustees Report recognized that, and wildlife management is very challenging, of course, and their statement was in response to call to our DNR to start trying to work more hand-in-hand with folks in the community. It's not been a policy that's been followed by other states, of course, as an example, just to our south in Illinois, and also over in Michigan.
We're talking with Paul Smith right now, outdoors editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He's joining us to talk about Wisconsin's approach to chronic wasting disease on the eve of the deer hunting season. And Paul, you mentioned different approaches going on in both Illinois and Michigan, and you especially zero in on Michigan. What is Michigan doing differently?
They have the advantage of finding the disease in two small areas. In 2008, it was found at a deer farm, and then earlier this year, it was found in three wild deer near Lansing, Michigan. Both of those sites were in the Lower Peninsula. And what they're doing differently is they're going at it very aggressively, and they don't show any signs of backing off on their policy. Just this month, they unveiled a campaign called Keep the UPCWD Free. As part of that, they won't allow Wisconsin deer carcasses to be brought into the state of Michigan whole. So if a hunter shot a deer in Wisconsin, they would have to debone the meat from the carcass and bring it back into Michigan. So they're using sharpshooters. They're issuing additional deer permits in an effort to kill more deer in that area near Lansing. They've already killed 1,500 deer. So their early efforts in Michigan look very much like Wisconsin's did initially. And I think what Michigan probably will do is stick to the course that Illinois has followed, where they continue since 2002 to use sharpshooters and aggressive measures to try to keep the disease in at lower prevalence rates. That's been the only way to try to keep it low, and who knows what will be available in the future.
And wildlife officials in Michigan have been pretty strong in expressing why they're taking this more aggressive approach. What have they said? It sounds like they're taking a long view.
Yes, they have. And this is one of the things that points out the contrast between Wisconsin and other states is the Michigan officials, for instance, have said this is, we may not see it in the next few years, but the impact will be seen by our grandchildren, by future generations. And one of their biologists has experience in the state of Wyoming, where the disease has been present for about 40 years. And his statements were that their deer herds there rarely, or they're dominated by deer that are 2.5 years old or younger. And the deer just don't reach older age because of the disease. And that, for instance, for some of our deer hunting community, including me, who likes to see bigger, older bucks with bigger antlers, that's a big concern. The disease is still being studied, and new information becomes available every year. So this information about it actually impacting the age structure and the size of a deer or elk herd is very interesting. And that's one of the things that really should cause concern to people and cause people to ask hard questions.
Well, so we can't turn back the clock on chronic wasting disease here in Wisconsin. We are where we are. So what would you like to see us do now that there's sort of a lighter hand with the management approach that we're taking? What do you think we should do going forward?
Well, just about half of Wisconsin still is considered non-CWD affected. So we still have a good portion of the state that doesn't have the disease. And if we had sufficient political support for some stricter measures and, to be frank, more education about the disease and the risks for the future, you might be able to get public support to start to put in place measures to increase deer harvests. And increase testing, get funding for testing and also for research. One of the things that's lacking now is a live test. So this disease can only be done on tissues taken from a dead animal. So the farmed cervid industry, the deer farms, and they may move animals that have CWD, but it can't be detected until after the animal's dead. There could be a rally to increase research, to increase the number of tests. This year, the state is only scheduled to test 4,000 animals. In 2002, it tested more than 40,000. And also, perhaps some political efforts to put in place things with our farm cervid industry to make sure that every measure is followed to prevent transmission from farmed animals to the wild.
You mentioned education. What kind of education would you like to see?
Well, you know, tomorrow I'll be one of about 600,000 people that'll be going out into the field in search of deer here in Wisconsin. And the messages related to CWD are very muted in Wisconsin now. For instance, the health department has, since 2003, recommended Wisconsinites get their deer tested for CWD and not consume any meat from a CWD-positive animal. I'm holding the meat from a buck that I shot 3 weeks ago in my freezer, waiting for that test result. And I've made the decision that I won't eat CWD-positive meat. But I would prefer that every hunter that's going to go out in the field tomorrow is carrying that knowledge with them, that this is our health department's recommendation, don't eat it, and that's echoed by the Centers for Disease Control. So that's one thing. The other is just the areas in the state where this is found, and hunters could actually play a role by shooting more deer and calling for longer seasons in cases, let's say, at the disease periphery. This year there's going to be no holiday hunt, which was a late December hunt that was generally used to help reduce deer populations. And if hunters were able to get a unified voice and they understood the risk associated with the CWD and the long-term health of their deer herd, I think that maybe we could see some changes in policy.
Paul, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Paul Smith is the outdoors editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about Wisconsin's approach to chronic wasting disease. His piece is up right now on the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Cauliflower is one of those standard vegetables that's available year-round, but peak cauliflower season is the fall, and some cooks consider cauliflower to be a winter vegetable.
There's also been a trend of using cauliflower as a stand-in for starches, like potatoes or even pizza crust. So for this Food Friday, we asked Lori Skelton to test out some cauliflower recipes.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How do you like to cook with cauliflower? What's your favorite cauliflower recipe? And have you ever tried to use cauliflower instead of potatoes as a pizza crust, maybe? Call and share your recipes, your expertise at 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Lori Skelton joins us now. She's one of our in-house foodies here at WPR. She's a Food Friday regular. Lori, welcome back.
Thank you. Good to be here on this topic.
Well, let's situate cauliflowers in the world of vegetables. Where does it fit in?
It's the same family as broccoli, Brussels sprouts, cabbage, collards, kale. This is a brassica. And unlike some of the ones I just mentioned, it's not as bitter. It's not as assertive, shall we say. It's still a tasty vegetable, but it's also one that, shall we say, plays well with others.
Right. I think of it as sort of a blank slate. It's the tabula rasa of vegetables. It seems like you can do anything of it and it just kind of goes along nicely. It picks up flavor and you can do a lot of stuff with it.
That said, I was surprised to find out that the different colors of cauliflower do actually have slightly different tastes.
And what colors are there?
In addition to the white, there is purple, which has more of the same antioxidant that you find in cabbage and red wine, so it's a little bit healthier for you. It's a similar taste to white cauliflower, except that if you cook it, you leach out the color. You lose the antioxidant and you lose the color. So the purple cauliflower is really great if you're using it raw. Orange cauliflower has a milder and certainly a sweeter, creamier texture and taste. And this is one that I discovered was really, really wonderful if you were using cauliflower underneath a protein. It makes a great base for roasted fish or chicken or even some pork preparations. Now, the one that looks like a fractal, the one that's that really interesting green, technically that's Romanesco broccoli that's sometimes called Roman cauliflower, a vibrant green color. The flavor here is nuttier rather than white cauliflower.
A lot of people hear cauliflower, and this is me a year ago. I've gotten into cauliflower again lately, but you'll think cauliflower, boring, bland, mushy. So how do we get that the downside of cauliflower?
The downside of cauliflower, I'm sad to say for most of us, is you boil the living daylights out of it, and that will, again, not only leach out the color of purple, but it does leach out some of the flavor. If you boil cauliflower in a lot of water till it is falling apart when you look at it, you've increased the weight of it by at least 10%. So it's taken on that much extra liquid and lost that much flavor when it wasn't a flavor powerhouse to start off with. So you don't want to boil it. If you're going to work with cauliflower that you normally think of as boiled, try steaming it instead, just a few inches of water, and try not to get it so that it is mush, unless you're planning to puree it and then add other things to it.
Now, what kinds of ideas and flavors did you want to play around with when you were cooking with cauliflower this time?
I always love working with cauliflower curries, making hot cauliflower curries. Again, it takes spices so well, plays well with others. So cauliflower curry was something I'd work with. I'd never tried making cold cauliflower salads where cauliflower is the main ingredient. Throw it in my green salads. That's always been lovely. But this time around, I pulled one of Mater Joffrey's home recipes. She makes a kachumbar salad, which I gather comes from the western part of India, from the Gujarat state, where you toss the cauliflower with cilantro leaves and a little bit of red wine vinegar. But instead of adding the oil to the vinegar to make a vinaigrette, you put the oil in a skillet on the stove, you pop your mustard seeds in that and get the oil hot, pop the mustard seeds, then you add the hot oil to the whole salad, so you've given a completely different style of vinaigrette to it. Really amazing salad.
This is raw cauliflower.
This is raw cauliflower that just has hot oil thrown on top of it. It's wonderful taste.
Food Friday, we're talking cauliflower with Lori Skelton, taking your calls at 800-642-1234. How do you like cauliflower? Do you like cauliflower? Are you a cauliflower skeptic? What would it take to get you to try some? 800-642-1234 is the number. We'll go to Steve on the line in Eau Claire. Steve, hi.
How's it going?
Good. What do you got for us, Steve?
So I got this recipe with you toss the cauliflower and you put it on a pan and you just kind of let it simmer. So you let simmer about 10 to 15 minutes. You let simmer. And you put a little garlic on top. You sauce it up. You dip it around. And, bam, you know, then you dip it in a...
Uh-oh, we lost the key final ingredient there, so we'll try to fill in the gap, Lori. So garlic, cauliflower, sautéed together. You could dip in a lot of things,
I imagine. Well, you can start off with just basic olive oil and butter.
That'd be great.
Several people said however long you want to cook your cauliflower, you can get very, very creative. You can either give it a flash fry in the pan with olive oil or butter.
Flash in the pan. Yeah.
Or you can let it very gently simmer with a little bit of extra of the whatever oil you're using. You really want to get decadent. Cauliflower loves bacon.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. So there you might even want to go low and slow on that as well. And, of course, you add garlic to it. That's amazing. You mentioned potatoes earlier.
Right, and you got a little sneaky.
Well, I have been told over the years that if you boil your cauliflower with whole cloves of garlic in milk and then puree it, it's a great and healthier substitute for mashed potatoes. And knowing what a potato fiend I am, I wanted to try this out on Wisconsin Public Radio people. So I brought in a pot of pureed cauliflower, didn't tell anyone it was pureed cauliflower, and I set it up as though I were taste testing two kinds of gravy.
Mm.
I wanted to see if anybody would notice. 50% of the people who taste tested that, quote, gravy challenge never noticed that it was cauliflower I gave them and not potatoes. I don't know as I would go whole out cauliflower as a substitute for mashed potatoes, but I could definitely see going half and half if you wanted to cut back on a little bit of starch, certainly up the amount of vitamin C, up the amount of antioxidants you eat. I'd put half pureed cauliflower in with half mashed potatoes. It'll be delicious and lighter in texture.
And would you tell people that you were doing this, Lori, or would you try to sneak it past them?
If it were my own table, I would tell them. For research purposes, yes, I snuck it by Wisconsin Public Radio folks. Let's put it this way. Nobody complained. There were no leftovers the day I brought this in.
Right. Well, there generally aren't. But yeah, that was a tasty one. And people I think are used to the idea of additions in potatoes. I know parsnips are kind of another popular one. But cauliflower, you know, they have a bit more heft to them.
A couple of people were in the know. And I've had a lot of people with some of the dishes I brought in this month, tell me, you know, this might actually turn me. I haven't normally liked cauliflower, but whatever preparation I came in with, it's like, I hadn't thought of it this way. This works. And I did have one person say, the cauliflower with the gravy really wasn't that bad.
Let's take another caller. We've got Jeannie on the line now in Jefferson County. Jeannie, hi.
Hi. I'm on the road, and I just thought I needed to share the recipe that I made for cauliflower salad. What's nice about cauliflower, this isn't raw, but it's kind of partially cooked. What I do is cut up the, make small bite-sized florets and put it into the microwave for about 6 minutes. And you end up with the cauliflower that's not mushy, of course, but then it's not raw, it's partially cooked. And it works out really well. So you chill that, and I put in chopped up celery and chopped up green onions and a little bit of bacon bits or, mm-hmm. you know, just crumbled up bacon, of course. Bacon always goes good with everything. boiled eggs that are in bigger hunks. And then the dressing is just basically mayonnaise with vinegar and a little bit of sweetener in it and salt, pepper. And it makes a wonderful salad. It can also substitute for potato salad
right.
if you want to go low carb.
Jeannie, thanks a lot.
Great idea.
I wonder if it would work, Lori. What do you think? Would it be okay to blanch the florets, the cauliflower florets, boiling water just for like a minute, and it might have the same effect as microwaving?
Similar effect, although I could see where microwaving would get them a little bit more tender. She mentions cutting them into bite-sized florets, and the one thing you don't want to do is waste too much of that cauliflower. You've got that inner core, which is perfectly lovely to eat, but that does take a little bit more time. So maybe if you were to blanch the florets and throw the inner core in the microwave, that might get everything a little bit closer to the same texture. But I love the idea of making an adaptation of potato salad. I love the idea of the eggs in here with the celery and the green onions. That sounds great.
We're cooking with cauliflower now on this Food Friday with Lori Skelton.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you a fan of cauliflower? Have you ever tried using it maybe for pizza crust or in place of other starches? What is your favorite way to cook cauliflower? Share your favorite recipes at 800-642-1234 or on the Central Time Facebook page.
We've got a recipe on the Facebook page. We'll get into that in just a moment. First, a look at the news with Kristen Durst. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our conversation with Lori Skelton right now about cauliflower for this Food Friday.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions about cooking with cauliflower or your suggestions and your recipes. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We've got a recipe there, Lori, that you should probably tell us about. Cauliflower and cheese, you know, you just, slather on the Velveeta.
Well, that's what a lot of us grew up with, and I do admit, I grew up with a lot of Velveeta. The British love what they call cauliflower cheese, which is cauliflower that's steamed a little bit so that it's started to cook, but it's not mushy, and then you put it in a pan with really good cheese sauce. And my favorite British food writer, Nigel Slater, has what he calls luxury cauliflower cheese. I brought some in this week. I tinkered with Nigel's recipe a little bit, and I wasn't exactly pleased with the outcome. So what's on the Central Time Facebook page right now is the end result of a lot of people commenting. I had substituted his sharp cheddar for Gruyere. Several people said it was just too bland. Some people loved it, and it's certainly an option, but there was a call for something a bit more robust. One person said, I like snap with my cauliflower. So the recipe I've got online suggests using a little bit of allspice to season it, a little bit of cayenne, or if you have what's called French four spice, quatre épices, which is one of my favorite things to use with vegetables, that would be a really great way to give this some punch, but still have this lovely, luxurious, creamy, silky, How many words can I say before we get yanked
more
off
adjectives.
The air? Okay. This is the type of dish that you would serve an in-law. This is the type of dish you serve when you want to impress somebody, but it's really not that difficult.
I suppose you could just make a cheese sauce, too. Just make a roux, dump some cheese and milk in it,
That's pretty much what this is, although the proportions that Mr. Slater has allow you to cook the cheese sauce for 15-20 minutes before you add it. So right there, that will also add some complexity to the sauce because you're cooking it low and slow. It really turned out beautifully well.
Well, we're going to go back to our phones now and take a call here from Heather in Madison. Heather, hi.
Hi there. I am calling to expand on the mashed potato concept of cauliflower.
Right.
In our family, we call them potatoes. My kids love them. It is basically what you've done already with the cauliflower, except for we put a little bit of milk in there, a little bit of cream cheese, a little bit of butter, and mix it up. And I use a bullet, or you can use a food processor, or even just a regular potato masher, and put all those things together really good. And nobody will even flinch with the fact that it's cauliflower. I've had people who've tried it who despise cauliflower, and when you mask it with cheese, they love it.
that's true. That's so good to hear. And you can really play around with it and have some fun with it. Again, that's a great foil for other herbs and spices. You can throw in plenty of parsley and have something green to go with your green eggs and ham.
All right, thanks a lot for the call, Heather. We'll go next to Tim in Cable. Tim, hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Yes, I'm a grillaholic, and I take the whole head of the cauliflower and put it in a aluminum pan, put a little bit of garlic on it, a little bit of olive oil, and cover it, and let it steam for about 20-30 minutes, and then I'll uncover it, and then let it brown a little bit, and then if you want to sprinkle a little cheese on it, it's absolutely delicious.
And that's the whole head. How much olive oil do you use for a whole head of cauliflower like that?
I'll take about 2 tablespoons. You have to have a little water at the bottom so that this actually steams. But when you take the foil off, you get the taste of the grill as well.
Mm.
And you can use any kind of cheese, Parmesan cheese, just a grated cheese of any kind. It's absolutely delicious.
Tim, that sounds fantastic. Thanks
absolutely.
So much for sharing that with us. Grilling is something I'd never even thought about with cauliflower.
Mostly because our grill is full of other things. One of the reasons I asked to do cauliflower this month is I have yet to do the roast a whole head of cauliflower in the oven, which is really trendy right now. I tried several different methods, and like putting it on the grill, you do need to have something to keep the cauliflower from drying out. So this caller uses olive oil, butter and garlic and herbs is good. One that was sent to me by several people involved mixing spices in with Greek yogurt, slathering that all over the front of the cauliflower, and then baking it. You need to be a little bit careful. The first time I tried it, the spices I used were too hot even for me, and it completely masked the taste of the cauliflower. So once you get your spice blend right, that's a really great way to do it.
We're talking with Lori Skelton right now for our Food Friday, and you can join us at 800-642-1234 as we explore the wonderful and surprisingly versatile world of the cauliflower. And we're going to go back to our calls right now. We've got Jared with us in McFarland. Jared, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Thank you for taking my call. I have one interesting way of doing cauliflower. I started doing this by pan-searing some florets in olive oil. I found out that it kind of absorbed too much oil, made them greasy. So now what I do is I break them down, and then I actually put the olive oil on my hands and kind of rub that on the florets so it doesn't get too much oil on them. And then I put that on a baking sheet in a 400-degree oven for about 20-25 minutes until they start to get brown.
Mm-hmm.
I take them out, and then I already have a pan heated up. I put those florets back in a pan on the stove, and once the oil starts to kind of crackle, then I hit it with about a quarter cup or so of white wine, and it really brightens it up. And you can also, instead of doing white wine, you can also do, and kind of make it more of a comfort food, is I'll hit it with, like, I'll make my own brown butter.
Mm.
And that really brings out the nuttiness, kind of, you know, puts another layer of it on there.
I was going to say, until you said the wine, it sounded like a lot of the Middle Eastern meze recipes I was running across. But the idea of having them pre-caramelized and then adding them to wine. I'm going to have to try that this weekend. That sounds incredible.
Fantastic. Jared, thanks for that. Sam is with us next in Wisconsin Dells. Sam, hi.
Hi. I heard the same idea about the roasting, mm-hmm. about the cauliflower. I chop it up, put it on a pan, cover it with some butter, salt, and pepper. Do you know about any other spices you can put for roasting?
That's a pretty basic. That's a pretty basic start Sam has with just the butter and the salt and roasting it, and then what should you try?
All right, start easy. A little bit of cumin, a little bit of coriander, which is going to be your base for some Indian dishes, but also for a lot of Mexican cooking. So start with those two spices. Play around with the proportions. See what you come up with. If you want to try something a little bit more assertive, go for cayenne. And then if you really want to get inventive, start playing around with things like cinnamon and cardamom. There you're definitely going to be getting into more Indian flavors. And just play around with proportions and see what you come up with.
A couple more ingredients you'd mentioned to us, Lori. Capers and raisins. I think you said golden raisins in particular. How do we put those in with the cauliflower?
I was really surprised. A lot of recipes will mention sometimes both of these together. Raisins, as sweet as they are, actually make cauliflower taste sweeter. They are a wonderful way to play around. So if you're looking to add sweetness to a cauliflower dish, throw in a little bit of golden raisins. Now, if you want to play up the... We mentioned at the top of the program that the brassica, this is not as bitter as some. Mm-hmm. If you want to play up that bitter edge of it, there you add your capers. That briny salt will play up that particular flavor component, and it's a lot of fun.
Well, a lot of playing to do, a lot of different ways to tackle the cauliflower. Lori, thanks, as
Absolutely.
Always.
Absolutely.
That's Lori Skelton, one of WPR's in-house food experts and experimenters. She is a Food Friday regular with us this month talking about cauliflower, and you can check out a fancified cauliflower and cheese recipe over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Rob, you going to make some?
I think I might. I mean, I want to try more of these things. I don't know what I'm going to try first.
Roasting the whole head. That sounds intriguing to me.
I like cutting it up and just roasting it in the
All
oven.
Right, we'll compare notes.
Winter is coming. To the southern third of Wisconsin anyway, with projections for a few inches on up to maybe 10 inches of snow, depending on where you are. Me, not so excited, but Veronica is, and so is producer Amanda Magnus. Hey, Amanda.
Hey.
Yeah, we are on snowflake watch, Rob, looking out the window, not seeing anything coming down yet, but I'm super excited about this. We have a lot of traditions in my family for the first snow, but Amanda, I know you are right there with me, right?
Yeah, and I'm not really a fan of winter in Wisconsin. I'm from the East Coast. I did not grow up with winters like this, but I'm actually really excited.
Why are you excited?
Okay, three-pronged answer to that question. First of all, it's November. This is an appropriate time for snow. It's not October, mm-hmm. and it hasn't been really cold up to this point. Number two, it's happening on a Friday night into Saturday. I don't have to go anywhere. I don't have to do anything. I can just relax at home. And number three, it's like 6 to 10 inches for our area. That's enough for me to play in and still have more left over. I can make snow angels, make snowmen. It's awesome.
Wow. And Veronica, your family traditions, what do you got?
Well, we always go out. This is kind of random, but we always go out for pizza on the first snow. We go out. We don't order in so we can watch the snow falling from a restaurant. So it has to be a place with a window. And then we do the thing that Amanda does. We kind of cocoon down in, and you don't have to do anything. Snow allows you to be lazy.
Yes, exactly.
All right. Well, I look forward to having my kids go out and shovel this weekend. Let us know your snow traditions, if any. Send us a message on the Central Time Facebook page or tweet us at Central Time WPR. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
Snowball throwing, that's what I'll do. How I'm longing to ski through the snow.